Thanks, everybody, for coming to this reading. This is really exciting for me and Cindy. And I think it will be really fun to get to share the work that we've been doing with everyone. My voice isn't great, but it's better than it was yesterday, so yay. And they gave me a microphone, so you can probably still hear me, even if I'm croaking a little. So both of us write, Cindy has actually been published. I write just to write. I haven't really submitted anything at this point, other than local poetry contests. And I really enjoy writing. I used to write a lot in the 90s when I was in my 20s, and there was a very active San Francisco poetry scene. I started writing again in 2017, and a lot of my stuff is pretty personal, and some of it is just sort of observations of living in San Francisco and the people I know. And so this really has not a lot to do with Amherst. I don't think I was writing poetry when I was at Amherst, but it was a great place to develop my vocabulary. and I'm very pleased that we have Cindy here as well. This was a pretty random event that came together. I just put it out on Facebook that I was doing some writing and that I would be happy to do a reading if people were interested. And I think Flora was the one who sort of jumped in and said, yeah, you got to do that. So, and then I was looking for someone else to read, and Cindy very kindly sent me some of her work, and I really liked it. So without further ado, I'm going to let Cindy get up and go first. And she's going to tell you a little about her stuff by herself. She's also got a voice, which I don't, so she's going to maybe try to project using the tools that Ron taught us yesterday. But I'll be using the mic, so.
So the last panel was about political activism, and there was a lot of discussion of the personal and the political, and I think that's a perfect context for the poems we're going to read. So, life is too short. That's life. My father, who is naturally too Irish, said, it's short. Life, said my mother, is more than enough. Too many people come up short just by giving in. In this life, our task is to eat, drink, love, laugh too much so we don't come up short. Life pushes you. It is a party guest with too much to eat and drink, shortchanging the waiters. But life is too short to count gray hairs and lost loves, to eat boiled potatoes without butter, to spend your last nickel on toothpaste, to grind your teeth at 3 a.m., to lick cupcake frosting alone, to squelch a red-headed spirit, to iron a funeral shirt, to chase after unresolved cords, to deny yourself peppermint sticks, to lasso empty promises, to explode airy castles, to flood your soul's doorways, to choke on inconstant love, to serenade a fickle mailman, to say nothing to the boy with dimples. Short, too, as life, is Christmas morning, the savoring of an eclair, the bloom of an iris, the butterfly's sojourn, the chance to be heard, the leaping gait that scales fences, the twinkle in your blue eyes, our days of courtship, our nights of bliss, the pause before the tsunami hits. So I'm a third grade teacher. Some of these poems are inspired by my students and what they've taught me. This one's called Childish Eyes. When I was a child, I saw spaceships in dust motes crossing sunbeam asteroid belts. I saw lost pearls in seafoam, pirate treasures washed ashore. I saw the Sahara in a sandbox, cathedrals in campfires, battlefields in bedspreads. When I was a child, I made the Amazon out of broccoli, alpine slopes from mashed potatoes and butter islands in warm milk. I followed fairies through the woods and drank potions made of air. When I was a child, I saw monsters in the shadows, witches on the wind, sharks in the bathtub, vampires in the cupboard, and Frankenstein in the laundry room. When I was a child, my world was bound by sidewalks and limitless as dreams. When I was a child, I saw like a child. When did I put childish eyes away? I kind of wish I had a podium. Is there a podium? But I'm stuck behind it then, so I'll just deal. I'm going to save this one in case we have extra time, because I'm aware of time. So this next piece, there was a thread going on our Facebook, our class Facebook page, about how many of our classmates have taken their own lives. This poem was written when a friend of mine who was not from our class, it was someone I knew from Portland, Oregon, very young, committed suicide. It's called Why. For this one unthinkable thing, you don't get to know why. For this unthinkable thing, why will burrow in your heart and grow like a weed, a canker, a tapeworm, an oak. In this unthinkable time, why will drop its duffel, flop on the couch, and stay? A drug-addicted, lying thief who saps your strength and breaks your heart and takes with no return. Why will pull you down the rabbit hole and never look back? Send why packing. Brook no arguments. Banish why from your door for this time and place, for this one unthinkable thing. Why is nothing but a useless punk. So I moved to Portland, Oregon about a year after graduation and got really involved in the theater community there, and it was the height of the AIDS epidemic, so I found my community and I watched it get decimated. And this piece is about that time period. It's called Dactyls. Deep from the shadows of mute love creeps forth a cold, cruel thing, heartlessly toppling royalty, peasantry, yeomanry, teeth bared, rending the mind's eye, cracking the heart's stone, tearing the soul's bones. Couched in the blood and the marrow, it hides, feeds, Grendel's disguised form. Hundreds and thousands of teachers and mentors and poets all fall, comets of jewels shining, lives spinning, eyes winking still as they face death. Mourners are lining the shores of the River Styx, steeped in their shared grief, sowing the names of their fallen ones, honoring life in this vast death. Silently watching them, leaders with hearts of stone stand, cold, mute. Hospital bedridden, IV and taut skin, sunk eyes, dry lips, sucking on ice chips, young blind Tiresias changes his form into old crone. Yesterday, he was here in our house, drinking wine with his love, clear-eyed. 25 years of age, hollowed out, beaten down. This disease takes all. Now, as the end of days steals him, he rallies his troops from his bedside. Stand and unweave yourselves here in this desert-like journey of wide death. Out of your hands fall shadows that stretch across continents long past. Rise, fight. Burn with me here under blue sky, here under red rocks. Striking his staff on the parched ground, the firebrand binds himself back home, lifted on fabric wings into the heavenly blistering sun's rays, off the dust, off the clay, off the world, following fluttering heart waves. Out of the heavens descends a strange new god landing on pain's bed. Life. Life. Life rising from ashes of years lost. What will we do with this new world? What will we teach to the next tribe? And I am a teacher, and I've been teaching for 17 years, and during that time, school shootings and what they now call active shooter drills, which were called lockdown drills, are a despicable new part of life. So these next two pieces are about school shootings. The first one's called Before and After Sandy Hook. Before. Everything here shines. light winks off the polished tile floors and loafs in cushioned walls and pours around the arcing library dancing on the picture books. Windows are everywhere, a world surrounded by sunshine, a transparent place. Even when Oregon gray fills the sky, light fills these halls. After. Today, windows are the enemy. Today, light invites death. Today, sunshine leaves us unprotected. Every step, the outside world threatens attack. Every shining tile is a dead child. Bullets shatter glass. Transparent worlds give no shelter. Light brings no comfort. The hallway has no end. I will double lock my door, draw the shades and my little ones close. For the next 8 hours, their lives, their 30 lives, depend on me to shield them inside a glass box. And this one I kind of dedicate to the students who made us wake up and organized the March for Our Lives and really reminded me that despair does not have to win. It's called Sheep and Wolves. Tend my sheep, the master said. They called him teacher, too. Are you sheep, dear ones? In times like these, you should be wolves. Fierce and strong, pack at your back, teeth bared and ready to attack. Rage in the temples if you must, dear ones, for we have let you down. There is a time to every purpose, and this is no time for sheep. And it's going to get a little more political now. So I'm saving a few. I want to make sure Julie has enough time. This one I wrote after the election. I'll bring them back if we've got extra time. So this one I wrote after the election is called Novus Ordo Seclorum. The sun rises on an ominous world. Our spirits huddle, our leaders hide, benumbed, afraid, or stupefied. Wake up! Brew dark and potent change. Speak incantations that conjure dragons. Wrestle gods and angels for practice. Cry havoc against the foe. Join the battle with pens and pitchforks. Do not go gently into this new world order. The last ones are specifically about the experience of women and girls. And this one I wrote for a little girl in my class whose name is Erin Asia. It's called Attitude. We don't know what to make of you, the fierce girls, the ones who fight. And so we call it attitude, backtalk, drama, disrespect, defiance, insubordination. Instead, we should celebrate your strength and wish it for our daughters. Who needs to revive Ophelia when Hercules is your sister? Good enough for government work. There is a place where we are good enough. In that place, we can let go of folded sheets and oil of Olay and bathroom scales. In that place, dust gathers without consequences. And Mr. Clean and the brawny towel man hide in a bottle while I Dream of Jeannie wreaks havoc at sea like Puck set free. In that place, hairstyles change every second, like a mood ring on your head. And psychedelic colors cavort across bodies of every gender with no hidden meaning. In that place, a pantsuit is a miniskirt, is a burqa, is culottes, capri pants, cutoffs, low-risers, hip-huggers, bikini brief knockoffs, and clothing is the same as going nude. In that place where we are good enough, we speak bravely to the boss and sleep the sleep of the just because we choose. And in that place, and in that place, and in that place, women are good enough for government work. There's going to be a couple F-bombs if you've got kids. I don't see any here. We're okay. Julie's like, yeah, here it comes. This one's called Salem Girls. Better watch out for Salem Girls. We're forged in a nasty crucible of starched collars and constricting rules where women are the root of all evil, easy prey for the devil. We're forbidden from tag or hide and seek because the men think idle play lets Satan in. Better watch out for Salem Girls because we will fuck you up. Our souls are lightning. They can't be contained. Crush and confine us in your Puritan fists and we will strike back. Better watch out for Salem Girls. We're turning the corner from 12 to 13. Now we bleed and now we see all of your hypocrisy, adultery, and lechery and we will speak because we're possessed, self-possessed. We saw Goody Osborne dance with the devil and heard Sarah Good, who begs at your door, whispering curses under her breath that sent your best cows straight to their death. The slave Tituba saw red rats and talking cats and a tall man all dressed in black and consorted with demons and messed with our heads while Rebecca Nurse tortured us at night in our beds. In our beds. Better watch out for Salem Girls because we will fuck you up. We travel in packs and throw seismic fits, flailing and screaming and hurling our bodies against walls. Stop by the courthouse and check out the show, but don't you dare threaten us or you'll be next. Like that bastard John Proctor and his wife Elizabeth. Better watch out for Salem Girls. We'll take your town with our inner storms. Your wives and widows and slaves will hang and hundreds more will rot in court. If you're ugly or different or you look at us wrong, we'll send you to hell with our spectral tongues. And hundreds of years from now, we'll still be the talk of the town. Because we're Salem Girls, forged in fire, burning the fuel of repressed desires, and we will fuck you up. I've got one more, but I gotta hydrate. And this last one is a little of a mashup between long past and current events. It's called Joan of Arc. Never doubt that you are valuable, said the archangel. And I didn't, though I was only a peasant, a nothing, a girl, who played with daisy chains by the fairy tree. That was a crime and a heresy, they said. And learned about herbs at my grandmother's knee. And she was a witch, they said, though we called her wise. And tended the horses and tended the sheep, which they also held against me. In a place known for nothing, nothing good. A place torn by war for a century or more. And I would have died that way, should have died that way, a peasant, a nothing, a girl. But never underestimate the powers of a girl when she passes the age of 13. The power to inspire, the power to believe, the power to cross boundaries that men cannot and will not conceive. I heard my voices when I was 13. I heard and saw, and I believed God meant me for other deeds than cows and sheep and a life brutish and nasty where soldiers of the enemy could have their way with me. You should know, though, when you're a girl, that even if you lead armies to victory and inspire kings and speak truth to authority and are visited by God and the heavenly host, they will still make it all about your hair and your clothes. As if wearing pants is a mortal sin worse than soldiers having their way. They'll call you names and say you lie. She was warned, they'll say, yet she persisted. You were warned, they said to me, yet you persist in heresy when you are only a peasant, a nothing, a girl. But never doubt. Never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and dangerous. Girls with voices frighten soldiers and bishops and other weak men. So they jailed me and grilled me with questions and called me witch and taunted and threatened. Speak boldly, said the angel, be brave. So I did, and I was, and they burned me alive. You were warned, they said, yet you persisted. In the crowd, little girls were watching, with eyes wide on the cusp of 13, beside their grandmothers, the wise ones, and their mothers, who carried milk in their breasts and heavy oak buckets on yokes across backs, and on their hips, babies and bundles of firewood. To all those little girls watching, I say, never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and dangerous. They burned me once, they burned me twice, they burned me three times, just to be sure, and poured my ashes into the river. And when I was dead, safely dead, long, long dead, they resurrected my name and called me saint. So, to all the little girls watching, never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and deserving. I burned for it with pride, and I'd do it again. A peasant, a nothing, a girl.
Okay, that's going to be hard to follow up. That was beautiful. I'm not even going to try. The first poem that I wanted to read is about a classmate of ours, and a couple of things that Cindy read are fairly similar to some of the things that I write about. And This is about Warren Kolodny, who was in our class, who was a friend, someone I really cared about, who ended his life. And I wanted to remember him at this reunion because I really wish he were here to join us and celebrate. It's called Warren. You're in the photo with me because we're both K's in some dissolving alphabetical line. That's you, Kolodny, behind Koltov. Our faces made paler by the black mortarboards and gowns. Your head is turned, so maybe someone is taking your picture too. A similar look of post-graduation disbelief in your eyes. My memory of you is from a winter morning, breakfast in East, the stillness of snow through the windows, and your soft voice, gentle and reassuring, even if I can't remember what was said. All these years, and I think of you, wish we'd known each other better. Funny that we were climbing the same impossible mountain and didn't know it. Your smile and your eyes stay with me, and I wish I could drink terrible coffee with you again, Warren. I wish you had not ended a life that had barely begun. I understand it, though, even as your death haunts me. Sometimes, when it feels like the mountain is winning, I think of that morning, and I start climbing for both of us. I should say that I've suffered from clinical depression my entire life, and so, you know, it's one of those things where I hear about people who take their lives, and I'm horrified, and at the same time, I understand how someone can feel that way. The other one I wanted to read next, because you had that poem called Why. I thought you might make a little jump to this. I have one called When. We did not, do this on purpose. Seriously, we didn't even know each other at that point. And I'm reading this next because When is about depression, and it's about me trying to put into words physically how it feels when I'm feeling depressed and I'm just sort of in it. So I hope this conveys it. When it arrives, it settles in, burrows into my neck like it loves me. When it's here, my shoulders are rounded by its weight, and I can only look down and wonder that my feet keep moving forward. When it has me, I can barely raise my voice. if I'm listening to you at all, it is so much louder with its sludgy lyrics that pound, echo, repeat. When it takes over, it tightens like a python and sinks its teeth, venom spreading until I am numb and flatlined. When it leaves, when I can turn my head to see it go, swallowing my pill, I know it will return, even if I don't know when. Okay, so to lighten things up a little, I have only one poem that rhymes. I don't usually rhyme. I don't know why this one rhymes. As you will probably note, a lot of these are kind of relationship-based, and this one sort of wrote itself, so take from it what you will. The title is Rat with a Pellet. New boots with a broken lace, old story with a new face, bottle of wine with no clean glass, girl bends over, your hand on her ass. Show me your prize in its battered case, play it and summon a moment of grace. Hard mouth with cigarette, you'll quit, you'll quit, you can't quit yet. Rat with a pellet, pulling the lever. Funny that once I could watch you forever. This one, I think a lot of women can probably identify with, and it's about being a woman and becoming comfortable with your physical presence in your body. I struggled a lot with, I had an eating disorder when I was younger, and so it's something that I still think about. You have a body, he said, which was a bit of an understatement. I have a struggle wrapped in a body, a love affair, an image seen through smeared glasses. I remember in second grade hearing, she has nice legs, and wondering what that could possibly mean. A sweet ignorance followed by an avalanche. I want to care less about this body, not notice the faint outline of ribs, and feel someone's approval, surely not my own. It's okay to like the round breasts, the pale pink nipples, violin hips, to touch the corrugated rib cage and just feel with your fingertips. You always wanted a body, even when you tried to destroy it. Now you need to slide under the bathwater and let your stomach break the surface like an island. He didn't need to tell you, you knew it already. Okay, here's my angry girl poem. Gotta have one of those. This poem was inspired by my soon-to-be ex-husband. not to get into it, I'm not going to. He's a wonderful guy, he's wonderful. But we were once walking to breakfast, and not that he ever criticized me or anything, but he said to me, you know, you're really not a glass half full kind of person, are you? Little things like that are what inspire poems to me, so here we go. Thank you. I am not the glass half full girl. I am the girl who throws the glass in a fit of anger. And despair and watches it shatter, making nothing better, but leaving micro pieces I will still be picking up months later. I will pour a steady stream into your empty tumbler, my other hand on a knife. Step carefully when you enter my house. Something might be broken. My poems are pretty short, so. I live in San Francisco. Many of you have been there. You probably know that we have a very significant homeless problem. We have way too many people living on the streets, and it becomes a something that you get used to, unfortunately. I take public transportation to work downtown every day, and I was getting off the BART train one day, and I saw this man sitting against a wall at the BART station outside, and he was like a saint holding pigeons. They were landing on him, and I kept turning my head and looking at him, and then I wrote this poem, and it's called Feed the Birds. He is propped against the wall at 16th Street, all black faded clothing, black headband, and long gray hair. His palms are turned up for the birds, some eating from his hand, others perched on his body. They are so comfortable, tamed by his stillness, his love for creatures that no one cares for. I keep turning my head to look at him, in this place that smells both of piss and jasmine. This is from my childhood. It's called Possum. They are building a house next door. It is a skeleton now, and we climb the spine of back steps so we could jump off the landing. Our bones are resilient, and no one is watching us in 1974. Back then, there are woods behind our house. Maybe he was born there, but he eventually crawled under the half-finished steps of the house next door. A small creature I have not seen before, but I know he is an animal simply seeking shelter. I have saved a baby rabbit from my cat, stolen an opportunity for nature to take its course. I have seen fear like this. He is backed up as far as he can go, his shelter now a trap, and the boys are laughing as they throw rocks at something they hope, perhaps, to kill. No one is watching them. No one will even wonder where they are until the summer night is truly dark. I can't do anything except run and find my mother, yell for her to make them stop. And she does, and the boys run off, weapons dropped in the dirt. The possum huddles, stares out at us, and I wish to communicate that he is safe, but I can't, and anyway, it's time to go inside. So the next one I want to read is for a classmate of ours who is sadly not here because she's off fencing, which is great. Right on. Right on. We're wishing her luck. Lisa Wolf, who is just a wonderful person, has helped me through some tough times lately. And last October, I came back for my mom's 85th birthday. And it was a time of great conflict for me. And she drove out to my mom's farm and took me out to this little funny diner down the street in Granby, Massachusetts. And she kind of saved my life. So I'm dedicating this to Lisa, wherever she is, hopefully winning a match. I know she's here in spirit. At the early mug off Route 202, the parking lot is empty at 9 a.m. Soon cars will pull in, but at 4 or 5, that's when the guys finishing shifts or starting them fill the little box of a place for their coffee, their eggs and toast, halved and buttered and pressed together, and cubes of fried potatoes uniform in size. It's as you might expect. A kind 60-ish waitress with glasses and white freckled arms, apologetic that they don't have sourdough, and then joking how she could really go for some. We'll be thinking of it all day. You and your friend are the only women here besides the staff. It's men sharing booths or eating solo at the counter. You are also probably the only two who graduated from a small, expensive private college a few towns over. The early mug doesn't care. Welcomes all who pay in cash, though back home in your city, no one seems to carry cash anymore. You let the waitress keep refilling. the plain white mug as you talk. Move your hands, shake your head. Your friend, listening, has work in a while, but for now she chooses to nudge eggs and potatoes onto her fork. You have so much broken in this moment. She is, as a nurse and mother and ex-wife, someone who can show you how to glue the pieces back together to form a better cup than the one you were carelessly holding before. Peeling back the lid on the tiny plastic jelly tub, she reminds you that when the catastrophe has laid waste to everything that resembles your life, there is only one thing to do. Joy in her voice, her eyes, she says, be the cockroach. She really did say that. Okay. There is a dwarf living in the nondescript house on the corner, and tonight he is outside smoking and ignoring the rain. As I approach under my umbrella, I make eye contact, smile, and say hello. He smiles, and I see that he is missing his top front teeth. This is not the kind of rain that sticks around. It's already slowing to a trickle, and in a few minutes, a strange, hazy light will settle over everything as if dusk were not about to drop. If he sees this, I don't know, as I have turned the corner and left my wet boots to collapse like dominoes. This is called 13. I think some of us maybe felt this way when we were 13. Hopefully not, but maybe you did. You are short, pale, not thin in spite of all the diets. Your hair is frizzy in the summer heat, and your teeth and eyes distorted by braces and glasses. Earlier in the day, you were dressed in matching yellow top and shorts, and your mother said you look like a giant chicken. Even the music on your Walkman couldn't drown out that remark. You stare out the kitchen window at him, the boy who will launch all your neuroses. He is tall, slender, black hair and flushed cheeks as he thrusts the lawnmower over your bumpy yard. You can feel the motor thrumming between your thighs, this smell of cut grass taking on new meaning. Later that summer, you will bake a cake from a recipe in 17. Chocolate with icing made from melted peppermint patties that form a stiff, inedible crust. You hope he will taste this offering and return your nearsighted gaze. But he stays outside, pacing the stubbled lawn until his father picks him up. In the fall, he will pretend not to know you as you pass in the hallway. But this is still summer, before high school begins, and many things are possible. You imagine becoming an entirely different girl by September. I guess I should explain this one a little. It's about a man that I met who was friends of some very dear friends of mine, and a man who I had been reading. He's a published writer, respected a lot. Met him, thought he was really cool, had coffee with him, and then in the light of the Me Too movement, I think this is a good poem. He started to send me these messages on Facebook, and they started out a little odd, and then they got progressively more overtly sexual. And when I said no, he persisted to say really offensive things to me that, you know, I was just blown away. And so I wrote a poem about it because that's what I do. You ask me to take it as a compliment. You're breaking and entering when I had cracked the window open in friendship. Maybe you had too much to drink and forgot your young wife, your baby, and that you barely know me. What did the blue eyes in your lined face see over that single cup of coffee that made it okay? And why did I wonder what I had done to encourage it? Of course, it's easier to let your erection talk from behind a computer screen. Say things that feel like hands roughly ripping my pants off, fingers pushing inside me, breath on my face. My violation is your compliment. You say when confronted that you went too far, but add, you don't know how gorgeous you are. A woman should keep her house locked tightly, not painted too brightly. Even in summer, a woman cannot leave the windows open. I think I may just be reading one more. I have some other things in my journal, but I didn't want to go too crazy with this. Yeah, I think that's good. Okay. I guess I should preface this. Maybe I did some posing for an artist. It was an interesting experience. Under different circumstances, we could have been in that photograph together instead of foreheads pressed together on a couch where I had arranged each arm, each leg in a different position and tried to stare unmoving at the opposite wall and not think about his eyes traveling over me, the scratching of brush on paper, the heat of lights making shadows for hills and valleys. Under other terms, I could have piled my clothing neatly in a corner and posed for more than two sketches, his hands never touching me and eventually himself. But these are the circumstances, and this is contained by a heavy door, a white brick wall, his phone making the ping that signals his wife has sent a text. He asks for discretion and apologizes for having to look at the time as he zips my dress. I walk out into the night, past the same homeless couple occupying a doorway with their small dog, the same man and woman I passed on my way to offer my body for drawing. Under different circumstances, they would be housed and clean and beginning to make dinner, but they turn toward each other, away from a cold wind that blows trash down the street and makes me hurry for the bus. And that's all I have for today. I just really want to thank everyone for coming. Demetra. Wow, thank you. Thank you very much. Things have been a little chaotic in my life lately. Go figure. But thank you for that encouragement. It's something I have been thinking about submitting some writing. So now that you have said that, it's a little kick in the pants to do so. Thank you. Anybody else? Thanks, Flora. I'm so grateful that people show up and want to hear it. Yeah. Yeah, Erica. I, And may I just say that your rap was just phenomenal. As a fellow white Jewish woman of a certain age, right on. Well done. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah, Julie. I personally do put stuff on Facebook a lot because it gets reaction and I find out what people like and what they, I don't know, what it gives them. And if this, since this is being captured by microphone, do you want to say that in here?
So I have a blog that's called Pamplemousse, but the address is a writer's play space. I think it's .com. It's through Blogger. Probably if you use my name with it, you'll find it more successfully, but that's where I post a lot of my poetry.
All right. Anyone else? That pretty much shut everybody up, right? Well, thank you for coming again. It's really wonderful to see everybody. This has been a great reunion, and I'm really grateful to be able to share my poetry, so thank you.